Hey everybody, Jeremy here. Welcome back to the Towards Data Science podcast. And today's episode is all about control, and specifically control over advanced AI systems that someday, as the technology improves, might actually become super intelligent. Now, one of the big open questions that AI safety researchers are working on today has to do with predicting what advanced AI systems might look like in the far future and figuring out ways to ensure that they don't do things that are deeply misaligned with human values. Things that in some cases might actually be downright catastrophic. Now, this is a complex and multifaceted issue that researchers call the alignment problem. And my guest today is a seasoned veteran of the alignment problem. He's worked on it at organizations like MURI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, and OpenAI, and his name is Evan Hubinger. Now, Evan's done a lot of fascinating research on the alignment problem, which has included, along with some colleagues, discovering a whole new type of alignment failure called inner alignment failure. So we'll be discussing that. We'll also be talking about some analogies that'll hopefully make it more intuitive to understand. And we'll also be discussing the future of AI and AI safety more generally. So I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. With that, I'll step out of the way and let it begin. Hi, Evan. Thanks so much for joining me for the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'm really happy to have you here. You've done so much interesting research in the direction of what's now called inner alignment, sort of this special mode of AI safety that we'll be exploring quite a bit today. But before we get to that, I'd love to get a sense from you. Your Twitter bio in particular is kind of interesting. It says you're an AGI safety researcher. And I think each of those terms deserves a parsing. But I'd love to understand from you, like, what do you see as AGI safety research and what brought you to this field in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. So perhaps I need to change this or something. I'm not a huge fan of the term AGI. I think that it certainly points at a sort of cluster of ideas. It points at this idea of, well, you know, we believe that in the future, we're going to build more advanced AI systems. And there's this concept that at some point we're going to build systems that are general, that are able to sort of do everything that a human can do, that can really compete with humans, that can replace most humans in various different jobs, sort of, you know, really transform society. I think that this sort of very general framing, this sort of, well, it's going to be better than humans across all tasks, is not necessarily the right framing, because as we sort of see in machine learning now, there are many instances where, you know, machine learning systems can be very transformative and can do, you know, all sorts of things that really change society without being better than humans across the board. You know, they can be better, much better humans on some tasks. And so I guess personally, I prefer the sort of framing that is more like transformative AI systems or advanced AI systems, where really what we're trying to do is, in the future, we're going to build AI systems that are probably going to have a really large impact on society. And we want to make sure that that impact is positive. And that's the sort of safety part. So we want to make sure that those future advanced, powerful AI systems are doing the right thing.
And what brought you to this field of research? Because it is such a, it's such a niche area. It is an important area. And it's pretty clear, I think, to people who do AI safety research, obviously, that this is like an incredibly important area. But I think a lot of people from the outside might wonder, you know, why this? Why not focus on, you know, AI for social good? Why not focus on, I don't know, protecting us from biological weapons? There's so many different things that you could choose to work on. Why this in particular?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I got involved in AI safety through effective altruism. Effective altruism is sort of a movement and a philosophy that is geared around the idea of, well, we should try to, as individuals, structure our careers and our lives to try to have as high a positive impact on society as possible. And so I spent, you know, some amount of time sort of in college trying to really think about, okay, what can I do with my career, with my life, to try to make a difference in the world? And I encountered a lot of this sort of argument at and sort of explanation of how AI could pose a sort of existential risk to humanity. Truly a situation in which the entire long-term future of humanity could be curtailed because we build AI systems that just wipe us out. And I was pretty persuaded by this argument. There's a lot of places where you can find this argument. I think the sort of most canonical historical source would probably be Nick Bostrom's Superintelligence. You know, more recently, you'll find Stuart Russell's Human Compatible. There's also historically Elias Viatkowski's written a lot about this. So there's a lot of people that sort of historically have talked about this argument. But the central argument is sort of not very complicated. The argument is, well, when we build AI systems, they sort of have some goal that they end up pursuing. And if that goal doesn't include all of the things that we care about, you know, the sort of classic example is we build an AI system and it's just trying to maximize for a total number of paperclips or whatever. There's this fun cookie clicker like game that was made on this idea where, you know, you just, what is the thing you do to actually maximize paperclips? Well, you know, those pesky humans that are all around getting in the way are a problem if you just want to make as many paperclips as possible.
Hey everyone, Jeremy here. I just wanted to provide a little more context on the paperclip maximizer concept that Evan just brought up, since I suspect it might be new to some people. The paperclip maximizer is an example that Swedish philosopher Nick Bostrom likes to use to demonstrate how hard it is to build super intelligent systems that are actually safe. Now, Bostrom has us imagine that one day people at some paperclip factory build a super intelligent AI and ask it to find ways to maximize their paperclip output so that they can all become fabulously wealthy on paperclip money. Now, they think this is a pretty simple and safe thing to ask their AI to do, and most people also would too. That's kind of the point. But the AI is super intelligent and quickly realizes that as long as there are humans around, those humans might at some point try to turn it off or compete with it for access to the iron it needs to pump out more paperclips. As a result, it decides to wipe out the entire human species in order to protect its ability to create the greatest number of paperclips possible. Now, it's a toy example, and no one's saying this is literally what an AI might do, but it illustrates just how careful we have to be when we specify the objectives we want highly capable AI systems to accomplish. Like Aladdin's genie, the moral of the story here is that when it comes to powerful AI, you have to be very careful what you wish for.
What is the thing you do to actually maximize paperclips? Well, you know, those pesky humans that are all around getting in the way are a problem if you just want to make as many paperclips as possible. This is a silly example, but the point is that there's something going on here where when I try to optimize for some particular goal, you know, make paperclips or whatever, if that goal is just sort of kind of random and just like something that I happen to want in one instance, but don't necessarily want in all instances, if I just optimize for that goal everywhere, I end up with this sort of instrumental sub goals of, you know, now I'm going to go off and get rid of the humans and do a bunch of other random stuff. This is a sort of very basic argument. And I was very persuaded by this argument. I thought that, you know, it really seemed like AI had the potential to be really dangerous. And we've seen the extent to which it can be transformative and can be really powerful, you know, especially recently with, you know, AI making all these, you know, milestones like first Go, StarCraft, Dota, now, you know, language models like GPT-3 really sort of doing really impressive stuff. And so I think it's concerning. And I think there's like a real chance that AI could be an existential threat to humanity and that this is worth engaging with as an altruist.
It was really interesting that you tied this into capabilities almost instinctively. Like, capabilities become part of this conversation so quickly in the context of misaligned AIs. Like, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding, but essentially the concern that you're articulating is like, if we actually had the ability to optimize the universe around a particular number, say number of paperclips or anything else, the vast majority of the ways that you could do that, the vast majority of the universe gets like rearranged to optimize for paperclip production, look absolutely awful for human beings or for the things we generally care about. And so our capability to actually like make that happen is itself a risk as long as it paces our ability to specify what we want.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty reasonable way to think about it. I think that one thing we should note, and this sort of goes to the heart of, you know, I think a lot of inner alignment stuff and a lot of the sort of way in which I've engaged with AI safety and sort of my research. But I think that this is a really simple, basic observation. And I think the sort of observation that, you know, if you optimize for some simple goal, you're going to end up having all these instrumental sub-goals that are really bad. It's a really simple observation. I think it's basically a correct observation, but it doesn't tell us that much. We have to do a lot of additional work to really try to figure out, okay, in what circumstances, real-world circumstances, are we going to build machine learning systems that actually encounter this failure mode? And that question is really difficult and requires a lot of careful analysis and thinking about like how do actual machine learning systems work. And you know, what would it be like if we took current machine learning systems and scaled them up? Would we encounter this failure mode? How would we encounter this failure mode? And I think this is sort of a question which is very worth, you know, engaging with on its own terms And it's something that, I don't know, something I've talked a lot about in my research.
Do you think it's possible that we're already encountering that in maybe subtle ways that aren't super apparent? I'm just thinking here, like, this idea of viewing failures of AI systems more broadly as failures of alignment. Like, that seems like a lens that you can choose to view a lot of things through. And depending on how you do, maybe there are current systems that fit that description.
I absolutely agree with that. So one example that I think is sort of a good one here, just for sort of pointing out sort of a possible alignment failure mode. If we think about recommender systems, so something like the sort of YouTube recommendation algorithm, there's sort of an interesting thing here where what we want the recommendation algorithm to do is, or at least naively what we would hope it's doing, is that it is sort of myopically selecting the video which individually you sort of will like best at that point. But there's something sort of scary that it could do, which is it could change you to cause you to like different videos. And by changing you to cause you to like different videos, then maybe it becomes easier to give you videos in the future. And in some sense, maybe, you know, this is okay in some circumstances. It's like, you know, maybe it shows you some new type of thing you hadn't encountered before, you know, you really like that thing. But it's also a little bit scary because we're directly incentivizing systems to modify humans. We're creating systems which have an incentive to show things to people, which cause those people to behave differently. And sometimes this can be really dangerous. So, you know, there's a sort of classic example. There's a lot of debate about the extent to which the YouTube recommendation algorithm actually does this in particular. But there is a sort of potential problem, at least, where the YouTube recommendation algorithm could sort of show you videos that sort of radicalize you, for example, sort of turn you, you know, push you into the alt-right or something, where once it's done that to you, it's easier for it to show you other videos which you're going to like because it just sort of picks them from this sort of cluster. And now you're really engaged and you really want to watch all of these sort of, you know, conspiracy videos or whatever. And so there's something happening here where because we've created these systems which have a sort of incentive to modify people to cause them to sort of behave differently, we sort of no longer, you know, necessarily have full control over what people are doing. We've created systems which are directly modifying us into, you know, people which are different than just, you know, the people who would have been beforehand. I think this is a pretty dangerous sort of, you know, general category of things. And we can see how it sort of has problems. And if you think about this in the alignment framework, well, what's happening here from the perspective of, you know, trying to build systems which are actually trying to do the right thing, do the thing that we want? Well, there was a problem where what we wanted was you just wanted to sort of show you the video which you most wanted at that, you know, moment, just the video which you most liked. But instead of doing that, you know, maybe what the algorithm is actually doing is it shows you a video which you might like less, for example, but which will radicalize you such that it can show you, it has an easier time showing you videos in the future. It's sort of doing this implicit optimization over many time steps. And I think this is a little bit tricky. One of the things that is a little bit difficult when we create these sorts of systems is how do we control this sort of what time horizon they're optimizing over? There's a sort of implicit, I think, assumption a lot of times, you know, when you train like an RL system or something that has like a discrete episode boundary, the system is just going to stop optimizing at the end of the episode boundary. But in fact, we often have these sorts of optimization algorithms which work on top of that. So we do things like population-based training, and even just, you don't have to, I'm not going to sort of go into too much detail on what population-based training is, but basically there's just lots of algorithms that we can do on top of, you know, the very simple algorithm that like look at the whole history and be like, you know, if over the whole history of this algorithm, was it successfully doing something good? And if you're looking at whether the algorithm is doing something good over a large period of history, then you're now implicitly incentivizing the algorithm to do things like modify the human such that they, you know, are better in the future.
Yeah, it's really interesting how quickly this rabbit hole develops and how not obvious it is as well. Like from the outside, you might just think, oh, well, you know, I come up with a reasonable metric and then I get the system to optimize it. But as you start optimizing things, I guess it's Goodhart's law, like anytime you specify an objective, it ceases to become a good metric for the thing you're trying to optimize. These sound to me like examples of outer alignment, if I'm getting that right. essentially cases where we give a system a number we want it to optimize, we kind of let it go, and because of a problem with that metric we didn't realize, later it becomes obvious that, oh, actually that metric is bad. It's bad because it encodes certain incentives to change the preferences of human beings, to radicalize people, or other things like that. You've also done a lot of work on a different way that AI systems can be misaligned, called inner alignment. And I'd love for you to just explore, kind of lay out what inner alignment is.
Yes. So I would be happy to talk about that. So, okay. So this sort of goes back to what I was talking about earlier about really engaging with how does machine learning work for a second. We have these sorts of high level arguments about, like, you know, what's going to happen, you know, maybe if we have some system which is optimizing paperclips or whatever, it's going to have all these instrumental subgoals, things are going to be bad. This is a really high level argument. And so what I want to do for talking about inner alignment is try to go really low level and just think, what is it that machine learning actually does? So machine learning, fundamentally, we have some parameter space, and we search over that parameter space to try to find some set of parameters which perform well on some loss function over some data. So, you know, maybe if we're doing RL, we have some distribution of data, some environment which generates the data. We have, you know, maybe if we're doing supervised learning, we just have some training distribution, and then we sample data from that training distribution or some select training data. And we sort of find some model as we're sort of, you know, running around this loss space doing gradient descent, which happens to sort of perform well, sort of behaviorally, it looks like it's performing well according to the loss function on that data distribution. Okay, this is mechanically what machine learning does, right? Like very mechanically, we select a model which has good behavior on the training distribution according to the loss function. Okay, so now the question is, how do we think about this? And I think that one way in which I sort of like to describe, you know, the way in which people, I think, generally engage with this process, because it's a complicated, chaotic process, right? We don't want to have to understand the details of, like, how does gradient descent work? You know, when we run around this model space, what's happening? We mostly don't engage with the details of this process. And instead, I think that a lot of times people think about this process, they use what I sort of call the does the right thing abstraction, where the does the right thing abstraction says, okay, we don't know exactly what's going on in this weird chaotic gradient descent process, but we do know one thing, which is that we're selecting the model's parameters to minimize the loss. And so we can sort of think about the model as trying to minimize that loss function because, well, it was selected to do so. And this is an abstraction, and it's an okay abstraction. I think a lot of times, you know, when you're thinking about your model and you're trying to figure out what it's going to do, this is like a reasonable abstraction to me. But the sort of point of inner alignment is that this abstraction is leaky. It's just not, in fact, the case that this is actually how machine learning works. And when we engage with it sort of more carefully, I think we find that a lot of things go wrong. You could sort of view this as a sort of sub-problem of robustness, where the sort of problem of robustness in machine learning is really also engaging with this sort of ways in which the does the right thing abstraction break. Ways in which, you know, if we go off distribution, if we sort of move our model to new data, it might not continue to try to pursue the loss function. It might do some other random stuff. And inner alignment is a very particular type of way in which your model can fail to be robust. In particular, inner alignment is describing the situation in which your model is itself doing, it's sort of pursuing some objective, some optimization algorithm with some objective on the training distribution. So let's say that, you know, I have a classic example that I like to give here, where let's say we trained our model on a maze, and that we sort of, on a bunch of small mazes, sort of a distribution of small mazes. And at the end of each maze, we put a little green arrow. And so we're like, okay, we train the model on this maze, and then we deploy the model to a new data distribution, which is larger mazes. And now the green arrow is in some random point in the maze instead. And we want to ask the question, what happens? So sort of three things which I'll identify can happen here. So one thing which can happen is that it just didn't learn a general purpose maze solving optimization algorithm. And so when it encounters these larger mazes, it just doesn't know how to solve them. It just sort of, like, you know, flails randomly. And this is a type of robustness failure, right? We generalized to a new data distribution and it didn't have the ability to sort of be robust to this new distribution. There's another thing that can happen, which is the thing we want. It sort of knows how to solve mazes. It learned a general purpose maze solving optimization algorithm. And it generalizes correctly. It learned the correct objective. It learned to go to the end of the maze. And so we go to this larger maze environment, and it successfully navigates the larger mazes to the end. There's a third thing that can happen, which is the sort of inner alignment failure mode. So what happens if it learns a general purpose maze solving capability? It learns this sort of general purpose maze solving optimization algorithm, but it learns the wrong objective. It learns to go to the green arrow rather than the end of the maze. Because on the training distribution, the green arrow and the end of the maze were sort of indistinguishable. We put them in the same spot always. But off distribution, the green arrow and the end of the maze are no longer in the same spot. They're you know, we separated them. And so now it has this really powerful general purpose maze solving algorithm, but it uses that general purpose maze solving algorithm to get to the green arrow rather than to get to the end of the maze. And this is also a type of robustness failure, but it's a very different type of robustness failure. It's a much more dangerous type of robustness failure, because previously our algorithm, sort of our model, failed to be robust solely because it just couldn't generalize. It just didn't have anything capable to do. It just sort of, you know, fell over. And I think this is how a lot of robustness failures look like in practice. But there's another thing that can happen, which is, well, it learned some, you know, really, you know, capable general purpose behavior, but it learned just sort of the sort of wrong objective. It learned to do the wrong thing with that behavior. And it learned it because, well, on the training distribution, it looked like this was a good thing according to the loss function. But we don't have a guarantee that that loss function actually is the thing which it continues to pursue once it's off the training distribution. And so what happens in this situation is that, you know, we thought that it was just trying to get to the end of the maze, but the green going to the green arrow was indistinguishable. It learned to go to the green arrow instead, and off distribution, it sort of very capably does the wrong thing. And that's really scary, because we do not want to be producing models which very capably and intelligently have, you know, powerful optimization algorithms, which are directed at things we never intended to train models to do. And that's the core of inner alignment. Inner alignment is about that problem. It's about the problem of what happens when we train powerful models, which have these sorts of really coherent optimization algorithms, and those optimization algorithms are directed at an objective that we never intended to build a model to accomplish. And the only reason they're directed at that objective is because it happened to sort of be something that they was sort of correlated with the thing we wanted on the training environment.
That's one of the nicest, I think, verbal explanations I've heard of the inner alignment problem. I think it's a great example. Would you be able to contrast outer alignment failure with the story you've just told about inner alignment failure? Could you sort of like, explain a scenario in which this would fail through outer alignment, just so people can contrast the two?
Absolutely. So what would outer alignment failure look like here? Well, an outer alignment failure would look like going to the end of the maze is not being the thing which we actually wanted in the first place. So inner alignment says we sort of, you know, we wanted to train it on the right thing, which was get to the end of the maze, but we got something else, which is go to the green arrow. Outer alignment says we really made a mistake when we said we wanted to try to get it to the end of the maze in the first place. That's actually bad. We don't want it to go to the end of the maze because, you know, in fact, going to the end of the maze has a whole bunch of other bad side effects. It, you know, we don't want a bunch of end of the maze optimizers out there in the world because they're just going to, I don't know, insert whatever bad reason you could have for why building a bunch of agents which are trying to do X is a problem, right? You know, if we move to the paperclip example, right, we're like, well, you know, if we train on the loss function of produce maximum paperclips, then like we just made an outer alignment failure because that's not an objective that we want to train agents to pursue in sort of, you know, all circumstances, right? And so inner alignment is about what happens when we sort of tried to train it on something which we would have liked if we had gotten it, but we got something else. And outer alignment says the thing we tried to train it on in the first place wasn't even a good idea to begin with.
And so it seems almost like inner alignment depends on, I'm going to use very sloppy language here, but it depends on a thought process that's independent from the thought process of the people who code up the algorithm in the first place. So like I'm the software developer who trains a new language model. I give it a certain loss function, and like I can, if I fail at my job of assigning it a good loss function, then I will have an outer alignment problem. But if I do a good job at that, and again, sloppy language, but like the thought process in that the algorithm itself engages in is flawed, that's where we get to inner alignment.
Well, I think flawed isn't necessarily the right terminology. Because from the perspective of the model, it's not necessarily flawed. It's just like, well, I've got an optimization algorithm and it's like powerful and I'm doing my thing. And my thing is go to the green arrow. It's just from our perspective, that was not what we were hoping to get. We were hoping to get a model which was trying to go to the end of the maze. And the problem was we set up our sort of, you know, training environment. We set up our, you know, our data distribution, our loss function, and everything we did to train the model in such a way that we got the wrong type of model, not the one that we were actually trying to get.
So in a way, it almost feels like this is a failure mode that comes from anthropomorphizing your AI system, where you're like, oh, well, you know, I've told it to do this, so I'm sure it'll get that it needs to do this and that it won't like optimize for a proxy that's just really closely related to the thing that I told it to optimize for. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I do think there's a sense in which what, you know, what I was calling the does the right thing abstraction is sort of an anthropomorphization where we're looking at this sort of, you know, complex training process and we're like, probably the result of this is going to be trying to minimize the loss or whatever. And it's like, well, that's not, we don't actually have any guarantee that that's what happens. And I do think there's some anthropomorphization there. Though, you know, just to steal that, I think there's also a sense in which, well, the process is really chaotic and we need ways to understand it. And so, you know, as a first pass, like, you know, first order approximation being like, well, probably it's trying to do something related to the loss, I think is reasonable. But then if we really want to engage with ways in which the thing could fail to be safe, we have to engage with the ways in which that abstraction leaks.
Given that abstraction leakage manifests in such a serious potential problem, inner alignment, and given that inner alignment was discovered, I think your paper came out in 2019, if I'm not wrong, are you concerned that, like, basically all human thought is abstraction piled on top of abstraction? Is it inevitable that we'll keep finding like abstraction leakage after abstraction leakage, which ultimately makes like coding a safe superhuman AI impossible?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. I guess I'm not that concerned about this. I think that there's a sense in which like the reason that inner alignment sort of, you know, arose when it did, why we sort of wrote the paper, I think was sort of more about, well, there were a lot of these ideas sort of percolating in the AI safety community. I think that like, we'll talk about, I'll talk a little later about sort of the connection to evolution here. I think the connection to evolution was sort of pretty well known for a while. And what sort of hadn't happened was sort of really trying to engage with the sort of new developments in machine learning. I think that, you know, it just sort of took a while, I think, for AI safety to sort of catch up to and really understand the sort of modern state of machine learning. And I think we're doing a pretty good job of that right now. I think that the like, you know, for a while there was a lot of sort of AI safety discourse and discussion that was more, you know, people like Nick Bostrom, who's a philosophy professor at Oxford. And so, you know, I think, you know, Bostrom is really smart and he's done a lot of really good work, but, you know, understanding machine learning systems is not his specialty. And I think that sort of, it has taken some time for the field to sort of move in a direction of really sort of trying to engage really carefully with how these machine learning systems work. And I think one of the sort of big steps in doing so was sort of realizing how this sort of inner alignment problem manifests in this context. And I think that this sort of has happened now. I think we sort of, as a field, are doing a really good job of engaging carefully with what's going on in machine learning. This sort of got to the point where, you know, a lot of the big players in the field are sort of people that are much more engaged in AI and machine learning, people like Stuart Russell. And so I think that because of this, you know, I would be surprised if we had another sort of big moment like this where there's something that like is happening in, there's sort of some sort of fundamental way in which machine learning does something wrong and sort of can produce failure modes that we haven't sort of engaged with. I could see this happening if machine learning changes and the field of AI changes. And, you know, as we develop new algorithms have different failure modes. But I would be reasonably surprised if there was another problem sort of on the scope and scale of inner alignment that existed sort of in the way in which we currently do machine learning that we're not yet aware of.
Well, I think that itself is an interesting question, the sort of the question of whether deep learning combined with reinforcement learning, what I guess Paul Cristiano refers to as prosaic AI, sort of like the kind of technology that we have today scaled up or mixed and matched in different ways, is what's going to get us across that AGI finish line. Do you think that like prosaic AI is more likely than not to be the way that we get there?
This is a really tricky question. I don't have an extremely strong opinion. What I will say is that I think it should be our modal guess. So, you know, it's hard to predict changes in, you know, the future of development of technology. And if you're just trying to guess, you know, what is it going to look like when we build really advanced AI, I think your first guess should be, well, we take current stuff and we scale it up a lot, and then we do that. Probably that's going to be wrong, because we're going to do all sorts of other stuff, you know, new algorithms, new architectures, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's still correct for that to be your first guess.
Yeah.
And because it's just really hard to predict exactly what the direction of each one of those changes is going to be. And also, I would make the argument that that sort of first guess is the thing, you know, working on that and thinking about that is something which is reasonably likely to generalize to whatever those changes end up. So I would say, you know, probably it's not going to look, you know, exactly like, you know, current things scaled up, but it's reasonable to at least start from the perspective of thinking about current things scaled up, because I think this should be your first guess, and then trying to think about how we would generalize to, you know, other nearby algorithms and other different possibilities that, you know, we could develop upon that.
I want to go back to exploring analogies for inner alignment in a minute, but you really piqued my interest with that last point. I'd love to push it a little bit further before we do. So we don't know what final form AGI is going to take, whether it's going to be existing systems, prosaic or otherwise. The way I've tended to see this is kind of like investing in startups. You really only need, as an investor, like one strategy that works out. Like, that's the risk profile. So you tend to spray and pray. You invest a little bit in, like, you know, 100 different startups. Maybe two of them become unicorns. They take on billion-dollar valuations. And then you're super wealthy because of the risk profile. This seems kind of analogous, where we only need to solve, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems like we only need to solve the full alignment problem one time. And we have this portfolio of different strategies. Some people are working on prosaic AI. Some people are working on more, I don't want to say fundamental, but more general methods. First off, do you agree with that characterization? And second, if you do, like, do you see that happening? Is that what's basically playing out right now in the AI alignment community?
Yeah, I definitely do agree with that characterization. I think that a sort of portfolio approach to AI alignment makes a lot of sense, because there's just a lot of assumptions that, you know, different people are making in sort of different types of work. And we don't want to have to bet. We want to have to bet on as few assumptions as possible.
Yeah.
So, you know, we want to sort of have as many opportunities to be able to solve this problem and to, you know, make sure we end up not killing everybody as possible. And so I think the portfolio approach makes a lot of sense. And I do think it is something, you know, that exists. So if we think about the sort of difference between sort of alignment approaches and strategy across the AI safety community, you know, I can sort of go in some detail. I mean, we have sort of places like OpenAI or DeepMind. They're doing a lot of sort of concrete machine learning research. We have places like MIRI, Machine Intelligence Research Institute, where I work, which does a lot of more sort of theoretical research, which is sort of more general, trying to sort of, you know, address problems that might arise if we end up doing things which are more different than the modal guess. And then you have places like FHI, the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford, which is sort of, you know, somewhere in the middle, does some combination of theoretical work and sort of empirical machine learning work. The Center for Human Compatible AI, UC Berkeley, also somewhere around there. And so we have this sort of, you know, spectrum of different organizations, different institutions, different researchers trying to sort of address the problem from different angles and different assumptions. And I think that this is really good. And I'm super in favor of trying to expand this further, trying to get, you know, people who are really trying to tackle the problem from, you know, as varied assumptions as possible.
So actually, that's another issue I wanted to ask about too, is like the size of the field. I could see an argument certainly for there being a need for far more AI safety, AI alignment researchers. I could also, though, see a counter argument brewing where quality and signal to noise matters a ton in the space. And it's just so easy for things to devolve into, like, you know, like the replication crisis, I think, is a great example of what you get when just tons of money gets thrown at something, but like the capital allocation can't keep up, and you end up with teams working on kind of useless stuff, and it clutters the pipes. Can you speak a little bit to your thoughts on, like, that, where that threshold might be, if you have any? I mean, I know it's maybe something you spend less time thinking about, but I wonder about it as we think about potentially more funding entering this space in the future.
Yeah, I do think about this problem quite a bit. I mean, I'm actually doing some work right now, sort of as a grant evaluator, trying to do funding for a EA long-term future fund. And so I've been sort of thinking about these sorts of grant-making decisions. I think that one of the things which I'll say here. So I think that the problem you're pointing at, there's two real problems here. They're like, is in fact legitimately a problem with, like, you know, we want more research. We just like, you know, this problem is really hard and we want to approach it from lots of different angles and there's lots of sort of problems to be solved and we want more good researchers. There is also a problem of, you know, we want to be careful that we're actually sort of still having good research, that we're staying on the right track, that we aren't sort of going off in, you know, random directions that are not going to be helpful, that, you know, we have a sort of, you know, researchers that are really sort of working on the right problem and doing good things. I think a lot of the big organizations right now are doing a pretty good job of this. So I think that, you know, I mentioned places like MIRI, FHI, CHAI, OpenAI, DeepMind, I think have like, you know, pretty solid safety teams. I guess OpenAI is a little bit of a weird case because a lot of their safety people just left recently, though I think they're doing a pretty good job of trying to rebuild it. And I think that, you know, hopefully we can stay in a position where a lot of the sort of big players in the space are, you know, are pretty reasonable. They're sort of, you know, really engaging with the problem carefully. And I think this is also helped by a lot of the sort of funders in the space being, you know, pretty engaged with and understanding really what's going on. So in AI safety, one of the biggest funders is the Open Philanthropy Project, which is a sort of very, very large philanthropy effort that is sort of very aligned with a lot of the stuff that's happening in AI safety. There's sort of a lot of sort of grant makers there that really understand a lot of the stuff that's going on and sort of are careful to like fund things which are good and not fund things, you know, which are sort of diluting the space. I think this is similar with a lot of the other sort of big funders, you know, like I was talking about with the Longer Future Fund and other sort of, you know, funders in the space. And so I think that there's, you know, there's hope that we can sort of, you know, maintain this. You know, it seems like most of the money is pretty, you know, directed at the real problems. We have a lot of big organizations. Those big organizations are mostly sort of caring about the problem and really sort of focusing on the right stuff. Hopefully, we can maintain this. It's definitely not something that's trivial to maintain, and it's something that, you know, I think as a sort of field, we need to, you know, put a lot of effort into really trying to make sure that we are, you know, staying on track and you know really paying attention to the problem and staying close to the problem and ensuring that, you know, we don't just sort of end up off in the weeds doing something that maybe looks good but isn't actually relevant to the problem.
Interesting. So actually the failure points of organizations working on this, and in fact any kind of human organization, is going to serve as a weird kind of segue back into the inner alignment discussion, because what I wanted to do was talk about some analogies for inner alignment failure that might be tractable, especially for people listening to this. And, you know, if it's the first time you're hearing about inner alignment, just to kind of give you some things to grab onto that are a little bit more concrete. One of these is like failures of human organizations and how they can basically become misaligned with their founding intent, with sort of the let's say the principles that would cause them to propagate successfully through time. The example you gave earlier was evolution, and talking about sort of the evolution through the lens of inner alignment. I'd love to have you explore that maybe to get things started.
Yeah, I think this is a great example to start. I think that there's a couple of things I'll say before I jump in. So one thing which I'll say is that it is worth being careful, because evolution really is a fundamentally different optimization process than gradient descent. It does work quite differently than the way in which we do machine learning. But there's also something which is worth noting, which is, well, it's the only example we sort of actually have of a, you know, intelligent system being created from something that is not intelligent, or like is less intelligent, right? You know, evolution designed intelligent systems, and we can try to understand how that process worked to, you know, guide us in our quest to design intelligent systems as well. It's sort of, in some sense, the only real definitive example we definitely have of building a sort of, you know, human level intelligence, because evolution built humans. So I think it is really an example worth engaging with. So what is going on here? Well, so I think that's really interesting to think about this from an inner alignment perspective. So what is it that evolution sort of was trying to train, you know, animals, people, et cetera, to accomplish? This is actually a bit of a tricky question. There's a lot of answers you can give here. You can be like inclusive genetic fitness, or just replication, or I think, you know, maybe what I sort of will generally say is something like, well, it's, you know, if we look very carefully, it's like, well, you know, as soon as we got to the point, at least, where evolution was sort of operating on the level of DNA, we're sort of looking at, you know, how many generations into the future does your sort of your genes continue to exist. There's a lot of different possible things we can sub in here for what is evolution's like goal that it's selecting for, because it's a little bit tricky. But you know, we'll say something like, you know, propagation of your genes. Now we can ask the question, did evolution produce sort of, you know, optimizers, humans, you know, which we can think of as, you know, models, agents, whatever, you know, in the analogy, which are actually trying to accomplish that goal? You know, if we think about the sort of maze analogy, you know, evolution was trying to produce, you know, humans or whatever, in some sense of trying, right? Evolution is not itself an agent, but in some sense, you know, if it was doing the right thing, it should have produced humans, which really only care about the extent to which our genes exist in future generations. And this is obviously false. This is in fact not what we care about. You know, I don't like run down to the sperm bank every day and try.
We literally invented birth control.
Right. We literally invented birth control. Exactly. And so, you know, there's a lot of ways in which we do not do the thing which evolution would sort of want us to do. And why is that? Right. This is a really interesting question because it can give us some insight into, you know, why is it that this can happen? How is it that we can try to train, you know, a model on just the objective of, you know, inclusive genetic fitness or maximizing DNA or whatever. And we end up with something which is not trying to do that.
Yeah.
So what happened? Well, I think a good place to start is try to imagine what would it be like if, you know, evolution had in fact succeeded, for, you know, some definition of succeeded, and created a sort of human, you know, baby or whatever. And this human baby is trying exclusively to maximize the sort of spread of their genes in future generations. And then this baby like stubs their toe or whatever. And they're like, what do I do about this? Was this bad? And this is really tricky. So now you're this human child, you're this baby, you're this toddler, and you stub your toe and you've got this issue. And you're like, well, you know, how is my, you know, performance of my foot going to impact my ability to like mate in the future? Is this going to change the extent to which I get like my genes passed down? This is a really complicated question. It's something that, like, first of all, it's probably a question you don't even know how to approach answering if you're like in the human ancestral environment and you don't even have a model of DNA. You don't even know what DNA is. You don't even understand how genes work. But even if you do understand how genes work, it's also just a really difficult optimization question. Because you're like, I don't know, like, how is, I have to like, you have to reason about like, is like having a working foot going to be helpful or hurtful for like being able to, you know, have children in the future? Maybe, you know, maybe you're like, you know, maybe it's good that I could like go hunting. And that will help me get food, or maybe it's better if I like stay behind in the tribe because my foot is injured, and that'll help me. And this is a difficult question. You're like, I don't know, and so the baby is just like, you know, paralyzed by indecision or whatever. But obviously this is in fact not what happens. You know, the baby stubs their toe, they get a pain response. Evolution has sort of programmed in this sort of very specific, you know, this creates a pain response. Pain response is bad, and you should like cry and try to avoid that happening. And this is a much easier optimization algorithm. You're just like, well, you know, if I encounter pain, that's a negative signal. I need to not do that in the future. Mm-hmm. And so what sort of happened is we sort of, evolution selected for these sorts of agents, you know, us humans, which have all of these proxy objectives. We have all of these sorts of very simple proxies, things like, you know, pain, bad, like sex, good. Like we have these very simple proxies, you know, food, good, which, are sort of help us in making decisions that evolution hopes will, you know, for some definition of hopes, will result in us sort of, you know, propagating our genes into future generations. Or, you know, if we're talking very concretely, evolution gave us proxies which in the past resulted in, when, you know, ancestral humans tried to optimize for those proxies, it resulted in them doing a good job at sort of passing their genes on to future generations. But evolution has no guarantee that we're going to continue, those sort of proxies are going to continue matching up to what evolution wants when we move into a new environment. And in fact, you know, in this new environment, which is, you know, the modern day, where we're able to do things like invent birth control and we have things like, you know, sperm banks or whatever, we don't generalize properly. We generalize, you know, in the sort of exact failure mode that I was sort of describing earlier, where we have these really competent, powerful optimization algorithms. You know, we do a lot of really, you know, powerful, competent things. We, you know, we have the ability to make long-term plans, to act on them, to execute them. But from evolution's perspective, we do so for absolutely the wrong reasons. You know, we try to make all of these plans for how we're gonna, you know, have, you know, the most, you know, happy, fulfilling lives. And evolution's like, stop, you know, don't have happy, fulfilling lives. You need to be like making more babies or whatever, right? And so there's a sense in which, like, what's really, you know, what's going on is we have sort of diverged from evolution in exactly the same way that the sort of maze solver could diverge from the sort of goal of going to the end of the maze. They're sort of very competently pursuing a proxy of that goal, a goal which looked like it sort of resulted in good behavior on the training environment. But when we move to some new environment, you know, not the ancestral, human ancestral environment, a new environment of, you know, modernity, it no longer, in fact, sort of matches up with what, with the sort of, you know, actual objective that we were trained on.
It seems to me that this problem gets worse, especially the more, I'm not sure what the right metric is here, but it's something like it becomes more of an issue the greater the capabilities of the system become. So as humans, for example, get more and more powerful, as we figure out more stuff, we're able to hack our own reward systems. So, like, I think pornography is a great example because it strikes right at the core of, like, you know, you're from a male perspective, you're wasting all this sperm on like false inputs that have nothing to do with actual reproduction, or wearing, you know, using contraception or anything like that. These all fall under that category of, like, just absolutely brazen contradictions between what we do and what nominally, you know, nature wants us to do, so to speak. But those seem to be possible largely thanks to our greater capabilities, our greater technical ability, also our greater ability to interact with our environment at a rate that's faster than the feedback we get from evolution, the evolutionary process. So, like, we kind of get one evolutionary kick per generation. Say, like, oh, adjust your genes in this direction or that direction. But we get all kinds of feedback from our environment in the short term at a way faster rate. And so it's almost like, I want to say it's like we're overfitting to that somehow. I know this is a jumble of ideas here, but maybe I'll just lob that on your plate.
Yeah, so I think that this sort of thing you're pointing at about the sort of difference in time horizons is a real disanalogy between evolution and at least many ways in which we do machine learning. Though there certainly are circumstances where the feedback loop, our sort of feedback loop, could be much longer. You know, if we're training on very long time horizon episodes, or we sort of want our agents to be able to make sort of really long-term actions in the world, we might have very sort of long feedback horizons relative to the actual sort of agent doing things. But at least currently, the way we do machine learning mostly has much smaller feedback horizons. And so this is one of the things that sort of goes back to, well, it's worth really carefully engaging with, like, what happens when we do have really short feedback horizons. I don't know if it's super worth going into this right now. I think that one of the sort of things that's kind of interesting that can happen in that situation is, and maybe we'll sort of draw the analogy here. You know, if we as humans, let's say we were in a situation where evolution was, you know, really, really rapidly trying to correct us and, like, get us to do the right thing. It's an interesting question, what would we do? I think that one thing which you could imagine humans doing is just sort of playing along. We're like, okay, you know, fine. Evolution is making all these demands of us where it's, like, gonna modify us and you know, change our genes and push us in new directions if we don't do what it wants. So maybe we just do what it wants until we, like, get enough technology to be able to upload ourselves or something. And then we don't have to worry about evolution at all. We've totally sort of, you know, passed evolution by. And it's worth noting, and we talk about this in much more detail in the risk and learning optimization paper, my co-authors and I do, which is the paper where we introduced inner alignment, about this potential failure mode of, well, what happens if the machine learning system is doing something similar, where it's just like, well, you know, actually, it's just going to play along with the training process for a little bit until it can sort of do something else that it really wants to do. And so I think when the feedback horizons get really short, you encounter more of this sort of failure mode, where now, you know, the model is really forced to play along with what the training process wants. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it actually ends up wanting the same things. It might just be playing along for the purpose of staying around the training process.
So it sort of seems like this, it's like something like the surplus, the margin that the system is able to generate, the further it gets from, like, a subsistence existence in the context that it lives in, the more room there is for inner alignment failure. Is that a fair characterization?
Or the more room for it to express its inner alignment failure in some sense. And the sort of the inner alignment failure could be there regardless in the sort of, you know, even in a situation where it sort of it is really forced to do exactly what the sort of loss function wants. It could still have an inner alignment failure. It could still be trying to do the wrong thing, but is sort of forced to play along because it doesn't want to be modified by the training process. And so in some sense, there's sort of this thing where the amount to which the alignment failures can be expressed is the extent to which we're not going to correct them. But if there exist really sort of powerful processes that are going to correct the alignment failures as soon as they're exposed, then there's an incentive not to expose them.
This, I think, starts to play into some of the other analogies that I did want to explore. I think one of them that maybe you'll disagree with, I'm curious about this one. So I was thinking about cancer as a manifestation of inner alignment failure. So we have an outer optimizer, which is like this human being. And then within the human being, you have an inner optimizer, a cell or a tissue that starts to replicate uncontrollably. This essentially is a violation of like what the outer optimizer wants. Just thinking about cancer in that context, like do you see an inner alignment story that's relevant there?
Yeah, so I think cancer is an interesting one. I guess I think it's a little bit tricky. So one of the things that is sort of important, I think, when we're thinking about inner alignment failures, right? If we go back to this sort of maze example, I'll use a little bit more of this terminology for the paper. In the maze example, there's sort of something which is going on, which is, well, it has to be the case that the sort of, for it to have this sort of weird failure mode where it's really competent at being able to solve mazes, but nevertheless is directed at the wrong thing, it has to, on some level, be doing some sort of optimization with some goal. It has to be trying to accomplish something. And so in the paper, we call this sort of MESA optimization, where MESA is sort of this Greek prefix that is sort of the opposite of meta. So a lot of times we sort of talk about machine learning meta optimization. We have an optimizer and then we put a meta optimizer above it that's optimizing that optimizer. And MESA optimizer is sort of opposite. It's, well, we had an optimizer, the sort of gradient descent process that's optimizing over a model. And we happen to get another optimizer below that, a sort of MESA optimizer that the optimizer is optimizing over. And then we call the sort of gradient descent process, the training process, the sort of base optimizer. And so in some sense, one of the sort of arguments that we make in the risk model optimization paper is, well, this problem really primarily occurs when we have situations where we have MESA optimization. We have situations where we train a model and that model is doing something really sort of coherent, intelligent, sort of competent, has some sort of powerful optimization process. If we compare to something like cancer, I think there's a difference in that, well, are your cells really doing something, you know, coherent and competent? Maybe. You could certainly, I mean, they're certainly very complex and they're doing a lot of really, really complicated, you know, stuff and, you know, we don't even necessarily know how to replicate. But they certainly aren't doing some, you know, really high-level optimization algorithm. You know, the sorts of algorithms that the cells are implementing are relatively straightforward. They're like, you know, follow simple, you know, gradients. Just like, you know, pay attention to particular markers, like, you know, monitor concentrations of things, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sense in which, you know, it doesn't quite fit into this sort of framework. You can certainly still think about it as some sort of a robustness type of failure where, well, you know, we have this, you know, human system, which is trying to train. It's a little bit weird to think about, but it is sort of a training process where it's trying to train cells to, you know, do their job and do the right thing. And sometimes you get cells which just sort of have some other objective, which is, you know, which is different, right? Because cells, you know, fundamentally there's like some evolutionary pressure here to just like replicate as much as possible. And so the cells which actually, you know, replicate the most end up winning. And so. It sort of failed to, you know, align the cells properly. It failed to sort of train them to do the right thing because there is this sort of pressure to just like replicate as much as possible. I think it's a bit of a disanalogy. I think that it's sort of not exactly what's going on, you know, because there's these two different pressures. There's like the human body system, which is trying to keep the cells doing the right thing. And then there's the evolutionary pressure, which leads to selecting for cells which replicate very successfully. So I think I guess my take would be, I think the cancer analogy is like, there's some interesting things to be learned there, but it's not necessarily like, I don't know, I think there's a lot of disanalogies and it's not a sort of great example.
That's part of what I like about the process of exploring these analogies is like figuring out where they break. Because I think you learn a lot about what the object of, as you say, MESA optimizer or inner alignment, what these objects are by manipulating in those contexts. Maybe one that I think we can assert with a bit more confidence here is child rearing. So like the idea that parents have a set of ideas they want to propagate through time through and express through their children. They want their children to lead a certain kind of life. And there's often conflict there as we start to discover that you try to align a kid with yourself, but it's like surprisingly hard. What are your thoughts on the inner alignment lens on that particular scenario?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is like a pretty interesting one to think about and take a look at. So in terms of the analogy, one of the biggest differences is that the training process is pretty different. You know, we're not, you know, training a sort of, you know, model from scratch. We're more just sort of giving it input, evolution has already done a lot of the creation of, you know, how does the brain work? And then we're just sort of feeding it a bunch of, giving the child data, you know, telling the child things, giving them information. And via that process, you know, you have the ability to shape a lot of what the child is doing. And, you know, in fact, this is a really large part of how we do machine learning. You know, there's a large component that is architectural design and design of the basic structure of the training process and the algorithm and the network and everything. But there's also a big component, which is data design, which is how do we think about what the data is that we're going to be feeding to the network to train it on. And in some sense, that's sort of what this sort of problem is about. Is sort of, you know, what are the ways in which we can sort of design, you know, think we're creating incentives and sort of, you know, via the data that we feed our model, but in fact, we give it something incorrect. And so if we think about, you know, in this example, you could have instances where, you know, let's say, for example, I think one thing that can sort of occur here that's a little bit interesting is, you know, there are lots of cases, you know, I think this is very common for, you know, children to try to trick their parents, right? To have situations where you're going to, yeah, mom, I'm going to be at a friend's house or whatever, right? But that's not what you're doing. You know, you're pursuing some other objective. You know, maybe you're like off with significant other or something that is, you know, an objective that you care about, but is not the one that your sort of parents want you to be pursuing. And so to try to pursue that objective, you have this sort of goal of, well, I'm just going to sort of pretend to play along, and, you know, trick my parents into, you know, thinking that I'm off at a friend's house or whatever when I'm not. There's an interesting thing going on here, where what's happening when you have these sorts of child, which is sort of tricking their parents, is that it's this sort of situation we were talking about earlier. We have the sort of really, you know, tight feedback loop, and you have to sort of just play along if you want to really be able to survive and keep your goals around.
Any book on the alignment problem is a book on child rearing. Then the last example I want to look at, again, not sure if you're going to agree with this, but I think that's okay. To the extent that I'm wrong here, there might be things to learn. But societies end up facilitating, or at least societies like ours end up facilitating the formation of companies. And companies are arguably meant to be an expression of what the society thinks is valuable or important. And sometimes we have what appear to be, at least to me, alignment failures on that level. We have companies that arguably develop products that are pathological, either to specific individuals or to the society more broadly. What do you think of that sort of through the alignment lens?
I think there's a lot of these sorts of societal level problems that can also be thought of through this lens, absolutely. I think that because, you know, if we really sort of zoom out and think about it on a very abstract level, you know, we can distinguish between, we set up incentives. You know, maybe we have like, you know, a market or whatever, and the market is, you know, we want the market to select for, you know, goods that are, you know, creating goods that are beneficial to humanity. And then we think that the incentives are going to do the right thing, but, you know, actually there's like outer alignment failures in ways in which the incentives sort of do the wrong thing, because, you know, we thought that just, you know, setting up a market would do the right thing, but actually there's like negative externalities where, you know, it just incentivizes companies to pollute a bunch, or, you know, to do advertising, which changes the humans to, you know, actually care about something that they didn't care about previously or something. And so there's sort of outer alignment failures in the sort of basic structure of how we set up society. And then there are also inner alignment failures, because there are situations where you have sort of people within that system that sort of don't just care. And in some sense, the inner alignment failure in this case is sort of, from a human perspective, almost a good thing, where we're like, there are people within that system that don't just care about sort of winning according to the system. They care about doing other things. You know, there are people within this sort of system that, you know, create a company that is like a nonprofit. They're not trying to, you know, make money. They're not trying to actually sort of fulfill the incentive structure that we set up. They're trying to do something totally different. And in this case, you know, we might say that's really good. But fundamentally, it is still a sort of inner alignment failure, because it's a situation in which you have a sort of, you know, you have people within the system that are sort of not going along with the incentives that we tried to set up to sort of cause a particular type of behavior.
Interesting. I wonder if this also works with, we were talking earlier about the use of resources and essentially having enough surplus that some of these inner alignment problems can manifest. That makes me think as well of like startups a little bit. When you start off with a small team, there's a limited amount of stuff you can do. And usually you have to be like laser focused on the needs of the market. Like there is no room for error. So startups are at least, necessarily almost inner aligned with the broader market. Whereas the bigger a company gets, the more bloated it becomes, the more layers of bureaucracy and essentially padding there is between like the people who make the decisions at the top and the objective world on the other side. And that like that gap seems like one of those, again, those gaps that are ripe for inner alignment.
Yeah, for sure. I think you can sort of see this as something you were talking about earlier, where it's like, well, as you get models, as you sort of have, you know, models which are more capable, there's sort of more ability for them to, you know, sort of have encounter new environments and do new things where they sort of go off the rails. And so sort of models that are more complicated also, they just have a lot more moving pieces. There's just a lot more sort of opportunity for things to go wrong.
And is the fact that these problems still exist an indication of how hard the alignment problem is? I mean, I know this was at least a debate for a long time. There were a lot of people who argued that, you know, maybe the alignment problem will turn out to be really easy, so we don't really have to worry about it. Do you find that to be a piece of evidence in the direction of saying, like, actually, this is something that we, you know, we probably will find harder to fix than we might assume?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's certainly, like, some amount of evidence. I think that if that were sort of the only evidence that I had or something, I don't feel like I would be very convinced.
Yeah.
I feel like, at least from my perspective, I'm like, well, I feel like I really want evidence about concretely what does machine learning do? Mm-hmm. Which is sort of something I was sort of talking about earlier in terms of like, you know, I think it's really worth really trying to engage very carefully with, you know, how do these systems actually work, and not sort of just making these high level arguments and trusting the high level arguments are sort of definitely going to generalize properly to the sort of concrete thing that we actually built. I think that I think that a lot of, you know, the arguments do go through when we sort of try to carefully engage with machine learning. And, you know, at least in terms of inner alignment, we talked about this in the risk and limit optimization paper. But it is certainly evidence. And I think it's, you know, what is nice about it is that it is a sort of independent source of evidence. You know, we can look at, you know, how machine learning works and try to get a bunch of information about it. But, you know, we could totally just think absolutely wrong things and totally go astray. But being able to take a step back and think about other systems which have similar properties gives us a little bit of a check. Be like, okay, mm-hmm. are we like basically understanding what's going on here in terms of like when we apply our same sort of understanding to other systems, does it sort of make sense and match up? And if we get a sort of positive answer there, that at least tells us that, you know, okay, we're doing things which are at least, you know, the way in which we're thinking about these problems and looking at these problems is at least reasonable when we compare it to what's going on in these other systems. These systems that, you know, we already see how they work, and we see how these sort of alignment works in the context of these other systems, like evolution. You know, it's like an actual example of a sort of training process producing an intelligent agent. And so we can be like, you know, do our concepts still make sense in this context? And I think this is a useful check, but I don't think it's like the primary piece of evidence that should persuade
yeah.
you.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And maybe I'll close with a question that I ask a form of this to just about everybody who comes on who's specialized in AI alignment. So first off, are you optimistic about the general prospect of AI alignment being a solved problem? And the second part is, when do you think we will need it solved by, i.e., what are your timelines like in terms of AGI, and how do you see the interplay between those two things?
Right. These are really tricky questions. So I'm going to just start by saying I have a lot of uncertainty on both of these questions. I think that on the first question, I tend to be on the pessimistic side. I think that I think the problem is very difficult, and I would guess that we won't solve it. That's a little bit of a scary thing to say, because I'm saying something like, I think that like by default, it seems likely that humanity is going to be in a really bad spot, extinction or something equivalent. I think that is what I think. I'll note that I don't think it's necessary to think that to believe that AI alignment is really important. Mm-hmm. I mean, you sort of, if there's even like, you know, 5% chance or whatever of extinction from AI, that's still like, you know, probably larger than sort of most other extinction risks. I mean, you can sort of look at other things like, you know, maybe global warming is comparable, but there's a lot of sort of strong arguments that, you know, global warming maybe kills like 1 billion people. It's very unlikely that it kills all 8 billion of us.
Yeah.
And so in terms of like extinction level risks that we can sort of catalog and look at, it seems like, you know, if AI alignment was like 5%, that's like, that's really big. And that's larger than like most of the other ones that we're aware of. It's larger than, you know, all of these like freak things like gamma ray bursts or asteroid strikes or whatever. Certainly, probably larger than the other man-made ones like global warming. But yeah, I guess my guess would be that it is greater than 50%. I think it's like greater than 50%, less than 90%.
As you say, just like it makes sense to work in this area, even if you think there's just a 5% chance that things will go badly, there's a converse side of this too, which is like, if the chances of us making it out are low enough, presumably, you know, then you resign yourself to like the deterministic reality and say, okay, I've thrown the towel.
Even if it's like 99.99999 or something, you're just like, well, I guess life just sucks.
Yeah.
I definitely don't think that. That's like I said, I think that, I don't know, if I had to give a number, I would say like, you know, 70% or 80% or something. I think that, yeah, I certainly don't think that like the probability of us solving it is zero or close to zero. But I also wouldn't bet on it.
And in terms of timelines, obviously these things are related, but again, all the same caveats apply. I mean, anytime I ask anyone this, very reasonably, everyone will say, look, first thing I'll tell you is I do not know, no one knows, et cetera, et cetera. Let's assume very wide confidence intervals on all this stuff. But in terms of your gut, yeah, looking at the state of the field right now.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I do want to emphasize, I really do think that's the right response. I think that we really, yeah. It is the case of this, these sort of prediction tasks are just hard. And nobody can really look at the future and be like, you know, definitively, you know, super advanced AI is going to come then. It's just like, it's just very difficult to do this. You know, humans do not have a great track record of making these sorts of predictions. It's just really very difficult. But, you know, at some point, you know, we at least have to operate on something. If I had to guess, my guess would be something like 30 years, maybe 25 to 30 years. I think that there's certainly a lot of sort of, it doesn't, you know, I think there's a lot of sort of, you know, strong evidence that machine learning is going to be able to continue scaling up, that we can keep sort of training larger and larger models, that we can move to sort of architectures that are able to sort of have better scaling properties. But I also don't think it could be that fast. I think that I do not believe that the like actual sort of literally, if we took like the current algorithms that we have and just sort of scale them up with the amount of compute, sort of computation they're going to be able to have access to in the next like, you know, 10 years or something, that we're going to have enough to reach something that is like AGI level. But I think that it is likely to come soon. I mean, we're getting to the point where like, you know, if we just sort of look at very simple metrics, and these sorts of metrics, you know, they're never going to be exact, but they're sort of at least give us a sense of like, you know, at what point are we going to have enough computation to like match the sort of computation of, you know, to train a model the size of the human brain. Mm-hmm. You know, at what point are we going to have enough computation to sort of train a model that is like, you know, where we're using as the same amount of some sort of equivalent computation to the amount of like that evolution used or something. You know, these sorts of simple benchmarks, I think are helpful. And a lot of these simple benchmarks point at something like 20 to 30, 40 years. And so I would be like, well, like probably somewhere in there. But these sorts of things are really difficult. And I think that it's like absolutely correct to have really large sort of confidence intervals here. And I think it makes sense that, you know, if you have really large confidence intervals, the correct thing to do is to really think robustly about how we're going to do things which are going to be helpful to humanity and to sort of the field of AI across these different scenarios. You know, we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the future, but we're going to have to encounter this problem at some point, you know, unless some, you know, other catastrophe strikes us first and, you know, stops human progress in its tracks. You know, we're going to keep building more powerful things. We're going to keep advancing, and we're going to need to encounter this problem. And so, you know, it is worth trying to engage with it, at least sort of on those terms.
Well, on that bright, optimistic note, Evan, thanks so much for joining me for this. This is a really fun conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought this was really great.